Welcome to this week's edition of A Degree of Interest with me, Monique Chambers, and my guest this week is Simone Azzopardi. Now, you're an assistant lecturer at the Department of History.
That's right.
That must be fascinating. What, do you have a specialism, or do you go across the timeline of the world? What's your favourite part, or which part do you actually lecture on? They're probably two different questions.
Yeah, actually, yeah, that's true. Okay, yes, indeed. As you said, I am an assistant lecturer. This is now my second year. And it is expected that you would have an area of specialisation, because how could you cover the whole history, right? And the specialisation, of course, comes from one's personal interest in the particular era or even aspect of history, right? So in terms of periodization, it's from the modern period, but more so the contemporary period that I am more keen on, and hence my specialization in that field. But then in terms of aspect, yes, it's political and social mainly. Of course, you can't quite separate between the different aspects. So, of course, the economic comes in as well. The social is very often sociocultural. So you have all of these interweaving aspects. In terms of my designation, that would be the modern and contemporary times, an assistant lecturer in modern and contemporary times. That's right.
To say how refreshing, because I like military history and war history. Right. My father was in the forces, and he came to Malta, and so I have that fascination. And so for me, the British military and war history in general is my thing. Don't know much about it. I'm not going to be asking you any technical questions. Don't ask me any. But so many people sort of go on about the Knights. I know they left a massive legacy, but there's so much more. There's so much more to Malta than the Knights of Malta. Yeah. What do you tell people when people want to come to Malta and visit? What things do you tell them to go and see? Is there things that they should investigate that you're like, oh, this is special. This is beyond sort of St. John's.
Well, conventionally, even when it comes to Maltese historiography, there has been so much focus on the order, and rightly so too, to a certain extent, because of course of the extensive contribution, but definitely not to the omission of what happened before and after that, right? In terms of Maltese history, my area of specialization then is indeed the British period.
Yay.
And political, yes, but even more so now social and cultural. And currently, in fact, I'm doing my PhD, my doctoral studies, and that's concentrating on the post-British period, post-independence Malta, from the cultural aspect. But maybe I'll talk about that a little bit later. So, yeah, when it comes to pointing at like the more interesting aspects, that's quite difficult. I try to, you know, like present everything that captures the very diverse aspect of Maltese history, which makes it up, right? I think Valletta would automatically, you know, like it brings in so many aspects, because you've got there, it's the city of built by the Order of St. John, and in so many ways it captures a lot of what the Order did here and what it represented. But there is the continuity then in terms of the role that Malta played as a fortress during the British period. Continuity and adaptation, and of course with that also comes the changes, right, that Malta endured during the British period. So captured in the infrastructure of Valletta, and with Valletta, of course, comes the Grand Harbour and the three cities, so the extended definition of what Valletta comprises. Captured in the infrastructure, in the monuments, in the general vibe even, right, that this open museum gives. There is so much of Maltese history that is very much tangible, almost beyond visible. I mean, it's very much tangible, and tourists, friends, can very easily learn so much about Maltese history just by going in the one city.
Because there's some little, you know, you turn your head, you know, if you look up at sometimes you see something, or you hear a story about something. Or my favourite part is actually Victoria Gate.
Right.
I love Victoria Gate. I wish I could just, you know, have that in front of my house.
Aesthetically, it's quite imposing, so, indeed.
Yeah.
And it goes beyond just the aesthetics and what these monuments, to a certain extent, right? These are monuments, what these represent, which, of course, brings the question or the point which keeps cropping up every now and again as to what we should do with these monuments of the British period or of the previous periods even. Should we remove them, change their location, replace them? And so on.
Because there were already street names were changed, weren't they, after the British left? So Republic Street, you know, my nana still refers to it as Kingsway.
Strada Reale.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So those sorts of things. But I think, like I say, it's an open museum to change things. I mean, if something's ugly, even that is subjective.
Right.
But most of Valletta is not ugly. And it tells a story. You know. So, I can't understand this.
Mm-hmm. One can understand like the different positions taken by different historians or opinionists, even in terms of like moving certain monuments to some other part of Valletta to give prominence to maybe other monuments that should be there that might better represent Maltese identity. This has been mainly with regards to the monument of Queen Victoria. but then in the monuments themselves, as in the location, there is, there is captured more than just what is represented prima facie, like the person himself or herself, or whatever is being commemorated. But there is a whole context which is being very much captured in that.
That's it, because it was considered at the time, and it was the best place at the time. And that's the time you're trying to capture. You're not. Mm-hmm. They probably weren't thinking about it for 200 years in advance. It was today, this person is commemorated in this spot for these reasons.
That's right, yeah.
And, you know, you can't go back and rewrite history.
And again, those who would think that certain monuments should be removed are not trying to erase history. But I can understand that, there are these opinions in favour of creating space for more Maltese representations.
Like the knot in front of...
Definitely not that.
You see, that's
definitely back to the.
You see, there's the problem.
That brings in the question as to what makes a good monument. Either what should be considered worthy of a monument. So that's always going to be open for discussion.
And I think as well, because there's been this movement for, you know, turning statues the wrong way around if there's sort of bad people in history, or removing them completely. All of this.
Mm-hmm.
If they're not there, people won't ask about them, and you won't learn about the history.
Yeah,
you know, so
there's bound to be that silencing.
Yeah, it disappears, you know, out of sight, really out of mind. And Queen Victoria sitting there with her Maltese lace, which she loved.
At least there is the Maltese element there.
Yes.
I mean, it was even commissioned through Maltese money. In most of these monuments from the British period in particular, there is, of course, the British element is very much there, and it was all propagandist. But at the same time, tied in it, are Maltese elements, which capture also this particular ambivalent relationship that there existed for the best part of the British period, right? It is so very easy to misrepresent relations as having been Maltese versus British, when in actual fact that was far from the truth.
I say, when you see a lot of the stuff that comes out about, you know, the theatre life, and you know, you can see that I'm a product of those times, essentially, because my mother's Maltese, my father's British.
Yeah.
That they must have had some fun, you know. There must have been some good things, and
indeed,
outside of even just the infrastructure itself, if Malta hadn't had the British, we may be more like Sicily. You know, so in terms of organisation and structure and the language, which, you know, has
depending
helped.
Depending on what Malta would have ended up like, or what it would have ended up being under in terms of foreign rulers.
That would be a really interesting film, actually, if the British hadn't come.
Counterfactual history.
But sort of, what sorts of things do you lecture on then?
Right, okay, so starting from the local sphere, considering that we are talking about that, I've got this particular module on post-independence Malta, which basically looks at the political transition, the economic transition, but also the socio-cultural aspect, because politically and economically, so much has been written, and of course that still requires discussion, but then there are some gaps as well. So presenting at least, or creating a forum for discussion also on those subjects is very important to me as a lecturer, right? To present that opportunity and present the tools of analysis for the students to do that. So, yes, that is one, and another one is very much related to that in terms of the cultural transformations that Malta went through after independence. And besides that, I also have very particular modules from European history, comparing France and German relations, Franco-German relations. That takes me to the early modern period. So in that case, yes, the time frame then extends a bit because it is, it is necessary to have as broad a time frame as possible, a timeline as possible. Go through the different stages of Franco-German relations to see how these developed, whether they were always at each other's throat. And as we know, indeed, there was a time when they were, but then eventually we see how this was replaced with the special friendship that makes...
The anti-British feeling.
The anti-British feeling, especially from the French side. In the post-war period, and how ultimately the special friendship forms the foundations of the European integration process. So that is one. The other one then compares or rather connects the relations of Britain and Italy in the Mediterranean.
Okay.
It's extremely interesting to see these distant countries so very different from each other in terms of politics, in terms of the economic aspect, culturally too, and yet how they struck relations out of necessity in most cases, as with so many other examples, and how their interests converged in the Mediterranean, even if they are not both of them Mediterranean countries, and this on the economic level, commercial level mainly, but then also politically, also with regards to the British indirect support for the Italian unification. And culturally as well,
because it's always fascinating when you see, because I spend a lot of time in Italy, and you see they love the British, you know, the people I come across love the British, or that's what they tell me. And then, you know, in England, you think you're in Italy sometimes. In my old high street, there were 14 Italian restaurants. All the hairdressers were Italian. So it's sometimes a bit of a like, where am I? What am I doing? But we never seem to emulate. We just want to be there,
yeah,
or be different, but mm-hmm. we never copy.
Not copy, no, but yeah, take things from each other, yes, adapting them, but not quite copying entirely.
It's quite strange. We've had all this time to have learned, and with the European Union and all of those things, because we always look up to certain countries for certain things and look down on other countries for other things, and yet they don't change and we don't change. It's quite strange. I always find that bit quite, it's not quite the same as history, excuse me, but McDonald's drive-thru is always busy, always busy. And I love them. But no one else is as busy as them. So why isn't anybody else copying the idea? It's the same thing,
right,
you know. Why don't the, you know, the, what the Italians love about the British, or the British love about the Italians, or the Maltese love about the French? Why aren't we doing those things? Is it the luxury aspect of it? Is it the... I don't know, the fact that it's not on your doorstep, that it is something you can dream about. Is that something that you look into as well, the sort of aspirational sides of things, the trends?
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is actually, I can tie this with another module that I provide, which is global history. And it is not in terms of covering the whole history of
the whole world.
Not at all. It is a method of doing history and looking at the aspects of interconnection. Mm-hmm. And here we are dealing with aspects that connect different people, that attract different people, right, from different parts of the world. And a very prominent theme and method of global history, so basically a methodology of doing history, is focusing on the globalization process, the history of globalization. And here we're dealing with aspects of globalization to a certain extent, right? The adaptation rather than the complete acquisition of aspects from the other from the other countries, but the adaptation to a certain extent, right, of certain aspects. To go back to the British and the Italians when it comes to the influences of the Italian Renaissance, and how these were then to you know take form and shape in the British context. They were not directly or literally emulated, but rather you've got adaptations thereof. So, these type of interactions, these nodes of interconnection to a certain extent is what really captures the essence of global history as a method, doing history.
Yeah. So the students that take your classes, are they doing full-on history, or is history some one of the aspects that they do because they're going into... I don't know, maybe they're going into politics or something along those lines, is it?
Yeah, right. Usually, of course, you would have the students who are doing history in another subject and in a BA course, right? But then, of course, you can have them from other faculties as well. So some are interested in journalism, for instance, others in European studies, others are coming from languages. So it's very varied, and the more varied it is, the better to a certain extent in terms of the discussion in class, because it becomes more interdisciplinary, which is something that we should all be aiming for, to bridge like the differences between the disciplines, because there's so much that could be contributed from the respective areas. Yeah.
And is history, is because it's something that we hope doesn't change, you know, that people aren't rewriting it, or...
Well, it is important to rewrite aspects of it.
Yeah, if it's been misled or...
Yeah, or if things have been left out, if people have been silenced by not being, you know, written about and represented. So yes, I mean, revisions are necessary and have been, I mean, that constitutes the history of historiography then, right? How history has been written. And yeah, like for instance, I've mentioned global history, that is one way of looking at what has been already explored, but looking at it from different perspectives. Right?
That's it, because there would have been, you know, even colonialization, whatever, it would have been seen from the, you know, a positive side or whatever, and you may not have heard the local side of the story.
Of the marginalized, yes, of the colonized people themselves. That takes us to post-colonialism then, the subaltern studies. Global history actually even says, let's not look either on the one side or the other, but let's see where the two sides interconnect, basically. So the trade, traffic, migration flows, looking at slavery, for instance, these networks that were established, for better or for worse. So it's not a question of passing judgment, but rather looking at what connected these people.
And the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth that gives you the full story. Well, you know, whatever truth we can find.
Whatever truth we can find, yes, or interpret, rather than, you know, finding the exact truth and, you know, this absolute objectivity. It's about mainly the interpretation based on the facts.
And so are history lectures just lectures, if you know what I mean? Or do you do field trips? Do you do, you know, anything AV? Is there stuff that people can go away and read and watch in their own time, or just start to look around and see? Because, you know, if you have history in it, because history at school was, you know, dates, names, things, and it was heavy, you know. Is it more fun now?
Definitely. Absolutely. Absolutely. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. No, I mean, it would be a pity if we were to just limit ourselves to, you know, the conventional method. Mm-hmm. Even when it comes to that, it's not just lecturing in terms of just passing on information, content, right? But rather, it's in provoking the discussion, provoking arguments, and making sure that there is a discussion going in the classroom, right? The lecture room. So, yeah, in the lecture room itself, the resources that one can use are so, they're varied, and besides the primary sources and of course, the extensive selection of secondary sources, visual sources are also very important. So, every lecturer, of course, goes about it his or her own way, but one can easily integrate workshops, seminars, and the department also makes sure to give the synopsis experience, the experience of synoptics to the students, the final year students, so that they can actually bring together elements that they have acquired and content that they have learned from the whole course, on the course of the 3 years, and apply the right type of tools, the skills that they would have acquired by that point.
Uh-huh.
But besides that, we also have, several of us lecturers actually organize site visits or go to the archives. Very important, for instance, to have visits to the archives, uh-huh, to actually show the students what the material that they could use is, where it is, how to use it, and that in itself, uh-huh, shapes ideas also about the type of research that they can undertake.
I think I have to say, and although I'm not anti-knights, but, you know,
I've got my preferences,
but one of my absolutely favourite places in Malta is the National Library.
It's just so fascinating.
Oh, the things in that, you know, in
stepping
just
in it.
Incredible, yeah. Absolutely incredible. And I've had the privilege over the years to go into the back rooms and see some of the stuff and see them restoring books and manuscripts and things, and it's quite overwhelming actually when you think what we have.
What
here.
A jam we have,
yeah.
Yes.
Yeah,
totally. And history students of course would already have that particular fascination without, you know, I mean, they don't really need to go to the archives. They would have to go to the archives, but they don't need to be taken to the archives.
They're going
to
go.
They're going to go anyway. But yeah, I mean, it's always so great to explore that and to also like share that sort of fascination in group, right?
But it's true because we did we were doing a project down there with some restoration and digitization of some of the books, and we were taking people around because we were raising funds, obviously, to be able to, mm-hmm, to do this. And we were taking people that hadn't been, you know, Maltese people that hadn't been
to the National Library.
And then, okay. Or they'd been when they were six with their nana,
yeah,
or something, you know, to St. John's. And that was the last time they really did anything touristy in Valletta.
Mm-hmm.
And they're probably the same people that as soon as they travel, they go to the first cathedral, they go to the, you know. But are we all generally lazy? Are most of your students Maltese, or do you have a mix of students learning? Because you have a variety of subjects. It's
of
not
course,
just
yeah.
Maltese.
And yeah, we have a mix, of course, because of the Erasmus students mainly, right? So, even there we can see like different attitudes, yes. But I think with locals in general, sometimes what happens is that we take for granted that we have what we have, and that might lead to less appreciation, maybe subconsciously even, you know, not even like...
Because I find myself, the other day, I sort of, we spend a lot of time in Italy, and I had to walk through the back lanes towards the supermarket, and I saw Nashar, and I thought, my goodness, that actually... That looks like an Italian village.
Yeah.
But you would never look at it like that normally. You'd like, oh, God, traffic. But, you know, mm-hmm, when you open your eyes really to see what we have, we really do have quite a lot.
That also means that we have to be very careful about preserving what we have.
And understanding it and learning it and being able to pass that on.
To appreciate it better, of course, it all boils down to understanding it. Otherwise, the appreciation is only going to be very superficial, right? So,
and that's it. When you go on holiday, you do these tours, or when tourists come in, and they you see something, you're told a story about it. It resonates much more than, like I said, the history books, the dates, the da-da-da-da-da. You go away thinking, oh, this happened there, or when did they wear that, when did they do that? So where would you have lived and when would you have lived, just as to wrap up the programme, you could have, I know it's a bit difficult because you've got all of these sort of areas of expertise, who would you have been when?
Oh, having a time machine has always been my answer to me. Okay, I think it would have been, besides being a feminist, a historian being also a feminist, I think it would have been, London during the period of the suffragette movement, being one of the suffragettes.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And I try to, I make it a point that through what we do in the department, the type of courses that we offer, we also integrate this aspect of the feminist aspect or the gender aspect more than anything, to provide that additional lens to our students to look at phases that have already been explored politically, economically, militarily, but to now explore them from the lens of from the perspective of gender, and most particularly from the...
Never even thought of that aspect, so I'm going to go back. in my time machine, and I'm going to do that. It's been brilliant talking to you.
Thank you.
Simone Azzopardi from the Department of History here at the University of Malta. Thank you for joining me on A Degree of Interest.
Pleasure.